Hello, this is Randy Thompson filling in for George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And today we're reading from The Issue, dated April 12th, 2013. We start out with the main stories. North Korea's escalating threats. What happened? North Korea caused growing alarm in Asia and the U.S. this week with a series of increasingly belligerent provocations, including renouncing its 1953 armistice with South Korea, announcing the reopening of a closed nuclear facility that can generate fuel for bombs, and threatening to launch a barrage of missiles at the U.S., calling his country's nuclear weapons program a reliable war deterrent. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un said he would restart operations at a shuttered reactor, which could produce enough nuclear material for one bomb a year. That announcement came just days after Kim posed in front of a military wall map showing North Korean rockets raining down on Washington, Los Angeles, and Austin. State media compared the U.S. to a boiled pumpkin vulnerable to attack. In a show of force, the U.S. flew B-2 bombers on practice bombing missions over South Korea and sent F-22 stealth fighter jets, a Navy destroyer carrying missiles, and other planes and ships to that region. The U.S. also prepared to deploy an advanced missile defense system in Guam, with Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel saying North Korea posed a real and clear danger to South Korea, Japan, and U.S. bases in that region. James Thurman, the top U.S. commander in South Korea, said he feared that a miscalculation on the North's part would lead to war. What the editorial said: in North Korea, is North Korea serious about going to war, asked the Washington Post. The worrying reality is that it is virtually impossible for outsiders to know for sure. But it's more likely that Kim is playing an old and familiar game, manufacturing a crisis atmosphere in the hope that the U.S. will eventually give more aid to buy good behavior. But President Obama should refuse to engage with a 30-year-old dictator, as previous administrations have learned. Answering provocations with diplomacy will not lead to concessions by North Korea, only to another round of provocations. There might be some logic behind Kim's bizarre threats, said the Wall Street Journal, but the problem with acting crazy is that it doesn't rule out the possibility that Kim is crazy. Maybe he really believes that a bloody showdown with the South will win him respect at home. And there's always the risk that one of his minions might get too eager to please the boss and launch an attack engulfing the whole Korean Peninsula in war. What the columnist said: Kim's not crazy, said Matt Spetalnik in Reuters.com. Following his father's death in 2011, the inexperienced young dictator has been trying to solidify his leadership, especially among North Korea's powerful generals. By placing his country on a war footing, Kim is now hoping that ordinary citizens and the nation's 1.2 million strong army will rally around him in a show of national solidarity. He might also think that testing South Korea's new president is a good bet, said Michael Austin in the Wall Street Journal. Kim hopes the talk of war will intimidate the recently elected Park Geun-hye, that he would have a complacent soul to deal with for the next 6 years. But Seoul is no longer willing to be pushed around, said David Kang in foreignpolicy.com. In the past, the South ignored even blatant provocations to maintain the peace. But after the North blew up a South Korean naval ship in 2010, killing 46 sailors, Seoul rewrote the rules of military engagement and promised to reply with force to any future attack. If Kim launched a similar strike today, it would quickly escalate into a larger conflict. Such a class would be disastrous, says Mark Thompson in TimTime.com. The North would be able to fire 500,000 rounds of artillery on Seoul in the first hour of a conflict, reducing the city to rubble and killing tens of thousands of people. But, as American officials have made clear privately for years, any attack on the South would be suicidal. Neither the U.S. nor South Korea would allow Kim's regime to survive. Washington and Seoul have made this threat clear to China, North Korea's closest ally. The only question now is whether Kim believes it. And under main stories, we also have this article, Progress on Immigration Reform. A bipartisan deal to reform the U.S. immigration system came a step closer to fruition this week as the country's largest labor union, its largest business group, and senators from both parties agreed on a guest worker program for low-skilled immigrants. The AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce approved the creation of a new visa program for up to 200,000 non-seasonal workers in industries such as hospitality, retail, and construction. Arrangements for such workers had been the main obstacle for the so-called Gang of Eight, Democratic and Republican senators working on bipartisan legislation. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, said that the agreement cleared the way for a comprehensive bill to improve border security, modernize the immigration system, and create a path to eventual citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. Every major policy issue has been resolved, he said. But Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, said it was premature to consider the legislation final, calling for ample time for senators to offer amendments. Perhaps it is the blossoms in the air, said the Financial Times in an editorial, but reform of America's broken immigration system finally looks possible. Yet Washington's chronic dysfunction could still bring progress to a halt. Legislation that smacks of amnesty will be opposed by a majority of House Republicans. The bill's fate depends on the ability of GOP leaders to stand up to those blocking reform. Democrats aren't playing fair, said Mark Krikorian in NationalReview.com. They seem to think the GOP is so desperate to pander to Latinos that it will simply cave on outstanding issues. They've rejected conservatives' demands for public hearings and a proper trigger to halt the legislation if promises to secure the border aren't kept. The result will be a grotesquely deformed bill, which Rubio shouldn't support. Rubio has a very tough balancing act to strike, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. He needs to show conservatives he's prepared to reject a flawed deal while also convincing them he has won major concessions. Still, by urging a go-slow approach, the senator is just giving anti-immigration hardliners time to intimidate pro-reform Republicans and kill the bill. He risked losing everything by encouraging the slowdown caucus. And finally, there's this under main stories, another prosecutor killed. A wave of fear spread through Kaufman County, Texas, this week after District Attorney Mike McClelland and his wife were assassinated at their home just 2 months after his deputy was shot in an execution-style killing outside the courthouse. Investigators are examining several possible suspects, including a disgruntled former public official who made threats after losing his job due to a corruption prosecution, and the Aryan Brotherhood, a violent white supremacist gang recently targeted by Kaufman County prosecutors. McClellan recently began carrying a gun and vowed to bring the scum who killed his deputy, Mark Haz, to justice, telling a friend they better come prepared because there'll be a fight. But he and his wife were found dead after they opened their door to someone who rapidly fired five or six shots from a .223 caliber rifle. "This whole thing is shocking to all of us," said Kaufman County Judge Bruce Wood. "I would be less than honest if I told you I was not worried." The Aryan Brotherhood certainly had motive here, said Kevin Krause in SeattleTimes.com. McClellan and Haz helped deal a serious blow to the prison gang last October, assisting with federal indictments against 34 members, including four top bosses. Law enforcement officials recently warned that the Brotherhood could be planning retaliation. "The gang has a track record of gruesome violence," said Christine Polisek in the DailyBeast.com. "But assassinations of public officials go against its normal policy. Having moved in recent years into organized crime activities such as drug dealing and prostitution, the Aryan Brotherhood must know that targeting officials would bring hate down on its businesses. It's more likely that the killer was a lone wolf acting on some personal vendetta." Regardless of who's responsible, said Scott K. Parks in DallasNews.com, "these killings mark an alarming trend. Over the last century, just 14 prosecutors have been murdered. Now, including a Colorado State prison chief gunned down 2 weeks ago, three have been killed in a matter of months. Are we entering a new era of organized crime and terrorism?" And that brings us to the section of the magazine entitled Controversy of the Week. This week, the controversy of the week is gun control. Has Newtown already been forgotten? Newtown was supposed to change everything, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. But 3 months after the massacre of 20 children in Connecticut, the NRA has already won, and meaningful gun control legislation now seems doomed to failure. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid will likely bring a bill before the Senate next week that would require background checks for all gun purchases and toughen penalties for gun running. But he has already separated out provisions that would ban assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, saying they're unlikely to pass. Republicans have vowed to filibuster even the watered-down bill if it includes expanded background checks, even though 90% of Americans support them. Last week, President Obama beseeched the country to remember how the killings in Newtown united us in sorrow, horror, and determination. "Shame on us if we've forgotten," he said. "Apparently we have. Support for stricter gun control laws has dropped 10 percentage points since the shootings, to just 47%. It's a major victory for the NRA, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, but supporters of the legislation have themselves to blame, too. Democrats can't agree which measures to support, while pro-gun control groups have failed to beat the NRA at its own game, making legislators fear the consequences if they vote the wrong way. Given the nature of the proposals before Congress, said Gene Healy in WashingtonExaminer.com, perhaps a little distance from the horror of Newtown is no bad thing. Universal background checks wouldn't have stopped Adam Lanza from carrying out his senseless massacre, since he had no criminal or psychiatric record. An assault weapon ban might have prevented him buying a Bushmaster rifle, but not the Glock and Sig Sauer handguns he also had. The reality is that school shootings remain extremely rare. We shouldn't let a single tragedy cloud our good judgment and spur a legislative panic that leaves us no safer and considerably less free. It's ridiculous to claim that gun laws wouldn't have affected Lanza's killing spree, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Though he owned handguns and a .22 caliber rifle, he went to the Sandy Hook Elementary School armed like a commando, with an assault weapon and numerous 30-round clips, so he could kill as many first graders as possible. Lanza fired off 154 bullets in just 5 minutes. Had he not had access to so much firepower, some dead children might still be alive. No rational person can doubt that robust gun control laws make us safer, said Adam Gopnik in NewYorker.com. Gun deaths are significantly lower in states with stronger controls on assault weapons, trigger locks, and storage requirements. Any impediment to violence, however low, is better than none at all. Even if Newtown produces no new laws this year, said Jamel Bowie in AmericanProspect.org, it doesn't mean it has had no impact. 5 years ago, Barack Obama and virtually all Democrats dodged the gun control issue, fearing its political cost. But now Obama is aggressively pushing for change, and in Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Colorado, and Maryland, governors and legislators have already enacted or are moving towards bans on assault weapons, limits on magazine capacity, and universal background checks. Just as gay marriage took 2 decades to gain momentum, the gun control pendulum has begun to swing in the other direction. It may take many years, but the politics of the issue are changing, and eventually something will give. That takes us to the section entitled Good Week For, Bad Week For. Well, it evidently was a good week for starting that diet. After a new airline, Samoa Air began charging passengers by the pound. Since heavier passengers use up more fuel, said CEO Chris Langton, there's no doubt in my mind that this is the concept of the future. It also was a good week for bargain hunters after a typo in a Macy's catalog resulted in a $1,500 necklace being priced at just $47. Dozens of customers snapped up the 14-karat gold and sterling silver necklace at stores before the department store took it off sale. And finally, it's been a good week for women. After Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban said he was considering drafting 6'8" Brittany Griner, collegiate women's basketball's most dominating player. Right now, I'd lean towards yes, just to see if she can play in the NBA, Cuban said. And it was a bad week for parenting after two moms had a fist fight at an Easter egg hunt in Seattle. When one mom pushed the other kids out of the way so her own kid could reach the eggs first. One mom got a black eye. And it was a bad week for sanity after a new poll found that 30% of Americans believe that a secretive power elite is conspiring to rule the world. And 15% believe the government adds secret mind-controlling technology to TV broadcasts. And finally, it was a bad week for Walmart shoppers after a Pennsylvania man was charged with whipping out a handgun, firing several shots, and killing a deer he spotted in a Walmart parking lot. After arresting, Arcangelo Bianco, Jr., a wildlife officer, conceded that it was the nicest buck I've seen taken in Indiana County. Takes us to the people section of the news. And we have these two articles, Skarsgård's naked upbringing and the pastor who lost his flock. Alexander Skarsgård was a true hippie kid, said Mickey Rapkin in Elle. The Swedish star of TV's True Blood grew up in a bohemian neighborhood in Stockholm where his father, Mamma Mia actor Stellan Skarsgård, would regularly host raucous parties for local artists, actors, and musicians. It was pretty wild, says Skarsgård, 36. I'd fall asleep under the table while people were partying till 5 in the morning. I was probably stoned from secondhand smoke. His parents' freewheeling lifestyle caused Skarsgård some embarrassment as a teacher. Dad was always walking around naked with a glass of red wine in his hand, he says. He didn't care if there were people he didn't know at a house. My buddies didn't care. They had seen him naked a million times, but it got a little uncomfortable when you brought a girl over, and Dad showed up naked with a glass of wine and tried to give her a hug. Despite those awkward moments, Skarsgård said his upbringing left him with a healthy attitude toward the human body, something he thinks few Americans have. There's such a taboo here with nudity. In some people's eyes, it's much more dangerous than violence. I never understood that. If a kid sees a nipple on television, how is that more damaging than watching someone bash someone else's head in with a baseball bat? And then there's this. The pastor who lost his flock. The Reverend Oliver White paid a heavy price for supporting gay marriage, said Sarah Duguid in the Financial Times. In 2005, the Minnesotan pastor voted in favor of a resolution backing same-sex marriage at the United Church of Christ General Synod. White's conservative congregation in St. Paul was furious. Within 3 months, my congregation collapsed from 320 members to just 70, he says. A lot of people left the church without a word. I would go to their houses and argue, but after visiting 10 families, I gave up. He received hate mail calling him a faggot. I'm not gay, he said, but I do believe in equal rights for all. As membership dwindled and donations dropped, his church fell into debt. One day an anonymous man called me and offered to pay our debts. I thought I was about to be saved. Then he told me, but I have one thing for you to do, repent. The church was repossessed last summer, and White has since searched in vain for a new congregation. My name was so tarnished no one would even rent me a space, but I still have hope. If I can just get a building, I believe I can form a congregation. I haven't quit the ministry yet. And that brings us to Best Columns, the U.S. And we start with this first of three articles entitled Massacres, Guns, and White Men. This is by Charlotte Childress and Harriet Childress, published in the Washington Post. Why are most mass shootings perpetrated by white males? Asked Charlotte Childress and Harriet Childress. In the debate over why America suffers so many killing sprees, race and gender are the elephant in the room. At Newtown, Aurora, Tucson, Columbine, month after month, year after year, it is seething white men and teenagers who use guns to massacre scores of strangers. The gun lobby blames flaws in the mental health system, but women and girls with mental health issues are not picking up semi-automatic weapons and shooting schoolchildren. White men are not used to being singled out as a cause of social pathology, but they make up 30% of the population but commit at least 70% of mass killings. Why? Why do so many white males find it fun to play violent video games? Why do white males buy guns in far larger numbers than other groups? And why are so many of them bitterly opposed to even reasonable gun control proposals? If we start asking honest questions about men, guns, and violence, perhaps we'll get some useful answers. The second article is entitled Rewarding Educators Who Cheat, and this is by Sol Stern, thedailybeast.com. Be wary of academic miracles, said Sol Stern. In school systems throughout the country, high-stakes testing has resulted in an epidemic of cheating, not by students but by teachers and administrators. The latest scandal involves the Atlanta school system, where 35 public school teachers and administrators were indicted last week on charges of tampering with student papers, racketeering, and theft. The indictment claims that former district superintendent Beverly Hall put unrelenting pressure on schools to drive up test scores by any possible means, and that she got $580,000 in performance bonuses as a result. More than a dozen other big city school systems, including in Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, and Houston, have seen similar allegations after test scores suddenly showed astonishing improvement. The unindicted co-conspirators of these scandals are former President George W. Bush and President Obama, whose No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top programs made high scores on standardized tests the only yardstick of success. As educators cheat to achieve unrealistic goals, politicians are happy to look the other way. It's a recipe for corruption, and the victims are our children. And finally, there's this. The Church of Baseball is open. This is written by John Avlon, CNN.com. Baseball is back, thank God, said John Avlon. This week, the reassuring cry of play ball rang out in major league stadiums across the country, providing proof that winter is over, spring has arrived, and the Church of Baseball has opened its doors. Many great writers and movies have explored and explained the magic of this child's game played by men. The blank slate that every new season presents, the game's slow, clock-free pace, with meditation and strategy interspersed with furious action, its deep connection to the past, with players competing not just with their rivals on the field, but with the great ghosts of baseball history, whose statistics and legends happily haunt every ballpark. Bart Giamatti, the former Yale president who became baseball commissioner, once wrote that our national pastime is designed to break your heart because it begins in spring, when all things are possible, blossoms in the summer, and then ends in the chill rains of October and leaves you to face the fall alone. But fall is now many months away, and there are green outfields and long summer days ahead for us. Play ball. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Talking Points. Title of this article, Gay Marriage, How Traditionalists Lost the Arguments. Is the legalization of gay marriage now inevitable? Asked Greg Storr in Bloomberg.com. During historic back-to-back hearings on gay marriage at the Supreme Court last week, a majority of the justices signaled that they were ready to strike down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which denies any federal recognition of or spousal benefits to same-sex couples legally married in individual states. The justices also indicated that they might use technical grounds to let stand a lower court ruling invalidating California's Proposition 8, meaning that gay marriage would again become legal in that state. Other states, meanwhile, would be free to continue to wrestle with their own decisions on same-sex unions. However, the justices ruled gay marriage has already won, said David Vondrell in Time. Today, it's legal in 9 states as well as the District of Columbia, and with stunning speed, public opinion is changing from the overwhelming opposition to growing support. Polls now show that 58% of all Americans support gay marriage as a simple matter of fairness, with support among young voters running as high as 4-1. Many conservatives concede that it's only a matter of time before gay marriage is legally virtually everywhere in the U.S. The issue is lost, groaned influential talk show host Rush Limbaugh. I don't care what the Supreme Court does, this is inevitable. We social conservatives actually lost this fight decades ago, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. Over the past 50 years, American society has rapidly moved away from the ancient tradition of marriage, a man and woman binding themselves together to provide a stable environment in which to raise children. In the wake of the sexual revolution, Americans started to view marriage as an expression of romantic love between two people, an instrument designed for companionship and self-fulfillment. Once the link between marriage and reproduction was severed, it was inevitable that gays and lesbians would demand and win admission to the institution. Nonetheless, gay marriage is a dangerous experiment, said Mona Charon in NationalReview.com. The evidence is already clear that changing the definition of marriage from a lifelong, exclusive commitment between husband and wives has not gone well, feelings being mercurial. The divorce rate has doubled since the 1960s, about 40% of all first marriages now end in divorce, and 51% of children born to women between 20 and 30 are born out of wedlock. Gays and lesbians didn't turn marriage into this mess, but they can perhaps understand that resisting its further redefinition is not bigotry, but prudence. At this point, though, your prudence leaves you on the wrong side of history, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Thanks to the efforts of gay rights activists, popular culture, and millions of our cousins, uncles, and children coming out of the closet, ordinary Americans have come to see gay people as human beings, not as threatening others. Public opinion has flipped because Americans no longer see gay marriage through the prism of tradition and religious authority, but as a matter of decency and fairness. If marriage enriches human lives, how can we deny that comfort and joy to Mike and Sam down the street or Sue and Ann at the office? Still, the battle for marriage equality is far from over, said Ronald Brownstein in National Journal. It's true that Democratic-leaning states are likely to approve gay marriage. Legislation is imminent in Illinois, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Minnesota. But the red states uniformly ban gay marriage, and among white evangelical Christians, 80% still disapprove of gay marriage, almost the same as in 2003. As a result, cultural conservative states dominated by those voters probably won't lift same-sex marriage bans soon. The future, then, is a nation even more bitterly divided than before, said Patrick Buchanan in the AmericanConservative.com. Red state churchgoers will continue to view homosexuality as unnatural and immoral, ruinous to body and soul alike, and legalization of same-sex marriage as another step in America's descent down a slippery slope to hell. Blue state secularists, meanwhile, now see homosexuality as natural and normal and believe that denying gays the right to marry is bigotry as odious as was discrimination against black Americans. It's a troubling and dangerous schism. If one half of the nation sees the other as morally depraved, while the latter sees the former as saturated in bigotry, sexism, and homophobia, how do we remain one united nation and one people? Also under Talking Points, we have this article entitled Millennials, the Insecure Generation. For the generation known as the Millennials, said Ann Lowry in the New York Times, the American dream is dead. The generation born in the 1980s and 90s is entering adulthood with less financial security than their parents or grandparents had, and the economic crisis of recent years has hit them disproportionately hard. The unemployment rate among 18 to 34-year-olds increased by 55% from 2006 to 2011, and a new study found that their net worth is far less than what their parents had at their age. Like those raised in the Depression, millennials have a deeply ingrained financial insecurity and are not buying houses or cars. They're keenly aware that for the first time in modern memory, a whole generation might not prove wealthier than the one that preceded it. And it's not likely to get better, said Michael S. Malone in Forbes.com. The 80 million millennials are trapped in almost a perfect storm. with globalization, high unemployment, and stagnant wages, making it very hard for them to establish successful, stable careers. What is a kid today to do? Relax, millennial, said Tracy Moore in Jezebel.com. Every generation is deemed wanting in some fundamental way by the ones preceding it. Trust me, I'm a Generation Xer. Back in the 1990s, baby boomers told us we were a bunch of lazy, weed-smoking slackers. And yet now a study by the University of Michigan has found that the majority of us are active, balanced, and happy. The generational hoo-ha about millennials means nothing. Like every generation ever, you'll turn out far better than your parents fear. Besides, millennials may actually benefit from growing up under tough economic conditions, said Jordan Wiseman in TheAtlantic.com. Most 20-somethings were too young to own houses or run up huge debts when the market crashed, leaving them without the financial scars of underwater mortgages or personal bankruptcies. We're also the best educated generation in history, said Kristen Iverson in the LMagazine.com. And the rapidly changing circumstances of our youth have made us quick to adapt and to innovate. We may not ever attain the status symbols of our parents, four-bedroom homes and $50,000 BMWs, but millennials may turn out to be more independent and idealistic. Maybe they'll do what the boomers never did, tear down an American dream that is based on profligacy and grotesque consumption, and rebuild it in their own image. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled The Last Word. And the last word this week is written by Kevin Lincoln. It's entitled The Man Who Knew Too Much. Ken Jennings made his fame on Jeopardy, said Kevin Lincoln, and now he's America's hardest working nerd. Ken Jennings will admit that during his record-setting Jeopardy run of 74 straight wins in 2004, he lied to Alex Trebek. It was about airline food. The host was interviewing him after the show's first commercial break, and by that point, Ken Jennings can't remember exactly when it was, at what point in the 1,800 minutes or so of airtime he occupied. But by that point, Ken Jennings had affably surrendered just about all of the harmless personal factoids he had to offer. So Ken Jennings told Alex Trebek that he liked airline food. Ken Jennings told Alex Trebek that he liked airline food even though he doesn't, or more accurately, even though he doesn't have an opinion on it one way or the other, because Ken Jennings understood the rhythm of the Jeopardy dance. Liking airline food is peculiar. Liking airline food would be fodder for the signature Alex Trebek brand of humor. Half eye-rolling dismissal and half knowing nod to the audience, like, of course he likes airline food, folks. This is a Jeopardy contestant. And sure enough, Alex Trebek raised his eyebrows at Ken Jennings. Ken Jennings further sculpted his role as the goofy savant who'd become Alex Trebek's foil, and the most memorable stint in the history of American game shows rolled on. On Jeopardy, knowledge begets money, but the money is beside the point, just a unit of scorekeeping. The contestants themselves are usually beside the point, too. Those personal anecdotes, taking up no more than 10% of the show, the rest reserved for a game of the mind, unusual in an American gleefully painted by itself and the rest of the world as a greedy, anti-intellectual society. It isn't reality TV, no personalities or rivalries, just a few good strivers engaging in brain competition, and you at home playing along with them. Jeopardy is both elitist and all-inclusive. Alex Trebek is its nominal star, but the real star is the idea that being smart alone is worth something, even if you're the kind of social oddball who likes airline food. Ken Jennings transcended the show by being the epitome of the show. Ken Jennings, to America, that type of name you can't help but pronounce in full, to the extent that even his then 2-year-old son would call him Ken Jennings during his 6-month run, became a celebrity in a celebrity-free zone. Jennings, the one-time programmer of healthcare software, is taking advantage of your familiarity to this day, publishing nonfiction books, writing a weekly news quiz for Slate, writing a weekly column about obscure world destinations for Condé Nast Traveler, debunking myths for Woot.com, creating a trivia puzzle for Parade magazine, and one-offs for sites like ESPN's Grantland, tweeting a handful of times a day and doing whatever else he can to keep rolling in his career as a professional smart person. Don't let the clean-cut Mormon good looks or aw shucks demeanor fool you. Ken Jennings is on the grind. I meet Jennings in a coffee shop in New York City, a continent away from his home in Seattle, where he lives with his wife, Mindy, and 2 children. He is here to promote his new book, Because I Said So, the 4th he's written since his $2,522,700 in winnings allowed him to quit his job as a software engineer. His current job description is emblematic of the social media age, being himself for fun and profit, which means being more than a little self-aware. I sort of peaked before I was 30, he said, laughing. It's already guaranteed that it'll say Jeopardy on my tombstone. Jennings partly credits his talent for memorizing cultural bullet points to a quirk of biography. His family lived in the Seattle area until Ken was in first grade, when Jennings' father, a lawyer, moved them to Seoul. Originally planning to stay for just 2 years, they stuck around for 11, with Ken eventually graduating from Seoul Foreign School. Growing up abroad, Jennings became obsessed with any artifacts of American culture that would make their way into Seoul. He and his classmates, expat children and military kids, would copy and share cassette tapes and figure out how to see Back to the Future when it showed on the Army base. Jennings was also taking cues from his parents, the type of people who kept reference books around the house, smart folks who were told by their friends they would create a super race if they reproduced. On rainy days, Jennings would sit around and use the books to build a connection between himself and his home country, studying, for example, local road maps of Delaware. Since childhood, he says he has tended to index new facts geographically so that his knowledge ends up clustered around locations. The first thing he'll remember about a person is where they're from, and the first thing he'll remember about an event is where it took place. After initially pursuing an English career at a major at Brigham Young, Jennings switched to computer science. The dot-com boom made it very easy for him to work for a classmate's startup. By graduation in 2000, he'd already become engaged to Mindy, who majored in theater and worked as a preschool teacher after BYU. Mindy, who spoke with me by phone from Seattle, said that her husband never tried to give off the impression of intelligence back in college. He also, fun fact, took 9 months to ask Mindy out after announcing to her roommate his intention to do so. He mostly wanted people to know he was funny, she said. He's not the type of person who wants you to know he knows everything. It's clear that Jennings doesn't view himself as an intellectual in the traditional sense, and this partly explains why he's been able to endure without the show. He's a product of pop culture who happens to know all the roads in Delaware. For so long, I was always the guy in the office who you could ask the name of a TV show or guys in a band, but that's not really valuable in the Google age, Jennings says. I'd always been good at that, but I turned my back on it because I didn't really think I could make a living that way. I thought being a programmer was a safe thing to do, and by accident, I became much more successful doing what I was actually good at. Jennings' post-Jeopardy days as a professional whiz have coincided with the general triumph of geek culture. He obviously is not one to miss such a thing. there's this idea of the jocks versus nerds thing. That sort of ended when the nerds won decisively. We now live in this era where your big summer tentpole movies can be hobbits and minor Marvel comic superheroes and boy wizards. If you had told me when I was a junior high there would be a $200 million movie about Hawkeye and Black Widow, I'd be like, "Hawkeye? That guy's lame," Jennings says. Those nerds started running Hollywood studios and are captains of industry, became Asperger types with acne scars. After the show ended, Jennings got an agent and a book deal, and once the book deal was in place, he quit his job, freed by the Jeopardy windfall in return to doing what he was actually good at. His first two books, Brainiac and Ken Jennings Trivia Almanac, were very much products of Jeopardy champion Ken Jennings, dealing directly with facts. With his third book, Maphead, about, yes, maps, Jennings started dealing with the way we perceive and represent facts, specifically geographical ones, though in a much less academic way than I've just made it sound. His new book, Because I Said So, is a natural evolution for him. It's a case-by-case investigation of time-honored clichés passed down by parents to their children that attempts to prove or disprove those weird half-truths of childhood, i.e., don't look in the microwave, don't cross your eyes, the five-second rule. He crowdsourced some of the clichés themselves, asking for submissions on Reddit, which supplied him with a couple dozen aphorisms. He did the legwork himself, figuring out which ideas had some basis in truth. Double-dipping does spread germs, and which were verifiably false. You don't need 8 glasses of water a day. His utilization of Reddit demonstrates Jennings' understanding of the Internet community, both on its own merits and as the world's best PR firm, and he's really taken to Twitter. Part of his bio reads, "Your grandma loves / hates him because he was on Jeopardy for a long time," and his banter is fully versed in the slightly off cadences of the medium. Jennings walks the balance beam of openness and insularity, exhibiting some techniques of quote-unquote weird Twitter while still making jokes about his children and Mitt Romney. When I ask Jennings if he considers himself a comedian, he demurs. Twitter makes you a comedian in the same way that digital cameras make you a photographer. But it's clear that he spends time thinking about the mechanics of comedy. He cites Spy magazine, a wit-driven New York publication that existed from 1986 through 1998, and was probably not broadly read among church-going Mormons of his generation as an influence. Mindy told me he'd discussed writing a book about comedy, which would seem to fit his M.O. Rather than functioning as a reporter or a critic, Jennings seems to be more like the world's greatest tour guide. He leads his readers through subjects, informing and entertaining them along the way, and then drops them off at the end feeling like they've accomplished something. Jennings has returned to the show for various Jeopardy tournaments of champions and a slightly more symbolic test 2 years ago in which he squared off against Watson, a trivia supercomputer developed by IBM. He came in second place over a 2-day contest with fellow former champion Brad Rutter, coming in third, neither able to quite top the computer's combination of speed and depth of knowledge, though both say they think they could have. "I really do think it meant something," he says. "I think it's very meaningful that when people would talk about the Watson match, they would always make jokes about HAL or Skynet in Terminator or The Matrix, all the touchstones where the evil machines were going to replace us. IBM would be like, 'No, no, 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 it's the helpful computer from Star Trek.' And people would be like, 'Whatever, it's HAL.' I feel like that must be a sign of something deep-rooted. We are worried about being replaced, and I felt that personally, being the guy who's got replaced, not just the competitor wanting to win. That was also, wow, the only thing I'm really good at, IBM duplicated in 18 months by throwing a few million dollars at it." In his dystopian future, nerds are replaced by better robot nerds, nerds without joy and humor and enthusiasm. And I suppose that maybe someday Watson will be engineered into the perfect nerd, but it will be tough to beat Ken Jennings. And that takes us to Poll Watch. 76% of Americans want more emphasis on the development of solar power and 71% on wind power. 46% want more emphasis on the production of oil and 31% on the production of coal. That's by Gallup poll. 49% of American adults admit they text and drive even though they know it's unsafe. 43% of teenagers make the same admission. That's from AT&T, USA Today poll. And that takes us to health and science. And we have this, a new stroke symptom. Doctors are urging people to be on the lookout for garbled text messages as a warning sign of stroke, even when better-known symptoms like slurred speech and numbness are absent. In one of only two cases of dyspexia reported so far, a 40-year-old man sent nonsensical texts to his wife before seeking treatment at a hospital. There, he scored fine on traditional stroke tests. He could read, he could write, he wrote a full sentence for us, no problem. He spoke fluently, Omran Kaskar, the Detroit neurologist who treated him, tells Slate.com. But when doctors handed him a smartphone and asked him to type a text saying the doctor needs a new BlackBerry, he wrote T-J-H-E, D-O-C-T-O-R, N-D-D-D-S, a new B-B. When they asked him to check the sentence for errors, he said it looked correct. That evidence led to a diagnosis of acute ischemic stroke, and it suggests that the brain may process texting differently from other kinds of communication. And then we have this, America's polluted waterways. More than half of the rivers and streams in the U.S. have a serious water quality problem, the Los Angeles Times reports. An alarming new study by the Environmental Protection Agency shows that 55% of America's rivers and streams are in poor conditions for aquatic life. EPA scientists collected data from roughly 2,000 waterways from major rivers like the Mississippi to small wading streams. The most persistent problem they found was nutrient pollution. Runoff containing nitrogen and phosphorus, common ingredients in fertilizers and detergents, fuels algae blooms that decrease the supply of oxygen and sunlight that aquatic plants and animals need to thrive. Land development has also greatly reduced the riparian vegetation that prevents erosion and provides shade to keep waterways cool. High levels of bacteria make 9% of U.S. stream and river miles unsafe for swimming, and more than 13,000 miles of rivers contain fish with dangerous mercury levels. This new science shows that America's streams and rivers are under significant pressure, says the EPA's Nancy Stoner. The survey found that water conditions were the worst in the East, where 70% of rivers and streams were in poor shape, compared with only 26% in western mountainous areas. And then we have this. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. Police in New Haven, Connecticut, frightened a pair of suspected car thieves into surrendering by barking at them like dogs. The two masked men had holed up an abandoned house where police surrounded them and threatened to unleash their canine units. But since there were no police dogs available, officers woofed like angry German shepherds. The suspects quickly surrendered. These cops were trained to do stuff like that, said eyewitness Gideon Gurley. And then there's this. Two Virginia middle school students are facing felony charges for allegedly spiking their teacher's tea with alcohol-laden hand sanitizer. Jane Miller, 66, said she didn't notice the germ X that the 13-year-old surreptitiously added to her drink despite its 60% alcohol content. When you're walking and teaching, you're thirsty, she said. I just gulp. The boy's motive is still unclear. It's hard to get into an adolescent's mind, said Miller. The class I teach was math review, and a lot of them aren't too keen on math. And finally we have this boring but important piece called An Embassy Fit for Kennedy. Caroline Kennedy is being vetted for the position of U.S. Ambassador to Japan, and the president reportedly intends to appoint her in the next few weeks. Kennedy, the last surviving member of President John F. Kennedy's immediate family, was an early Obama supporter and served as co-chairwoman of his re-election campaign. Her appointment would continue a long tradition of rewarding political support with ambassadorships, but critics have attacked Kennedy's lack of government and business experience, pointing out that she was forced to abandon her last brief venture into politics, a bid for one of New York Senate seats in 2008, after a series of awkward public appearances. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long. Until next time.